the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on its 75th anniversary. If Britain and France had had their way, it would not have been universal.
People sometimes say it's a colonial document, but in fact, the colonial powers didn't want this document to pertain to people in the colonies. Britain and France actively fought against making it pertain to people in the colonies, but representatives from the colonies said, we want this document to pertain to everyone. It's simply not true that we're lesser beings and we can't enjoy human rights yet. So they were the ones that pushed for it, and that's how it got in.
Of course, lots of countries deny basic human rights laid down in the Declaration. Israel, for instance, in the occupied Palestinian territories.
Israeli military orders criminalize almost every aspect of a Palestinian life. The whole system is built so no true justice is given to Palestinians. There's no actual rule of law being implemented. You don't have any rights or any protection where you are living, and this is your homeland.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Today, Sunday, December 10th, is the 75th anniversary of the international community's most canonical human rights statement, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, promulgated by the UN General Assembly on December 10, 1948, in the wake of the horrors of World War II, the Declaration set forth what its drafters considered the most basic human rights all people should enjoy, regardless of race, religious creed, or nationality. Indeed, none of these human categories appear in the Declaration. The Magna Carta of Human Rights, Eleanor Roosevelt called it. I spoke about the Universal Declaration with Rhoda Howard Hassman. Hassman is Emeritus Professor at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario, specializing in international human rights. Her books include State Food Crimes, The Human Right to Citizenship, Can Globalization Promote Human Rights, Reparations to Africa, The Age of Apology, and In Defense of Universal Human Rights. Hello, Rhoda Howard Hassman. Thank you for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about the Declaration briefly? Can you summarize for us what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was, what it is?
Well, what it is a normative statement about what human rights should be universally for all human beings. It's not a treaty. It doesn't have legal force. Many people think it is a Western document, but it is not. 56 independent countries were involved in writing the document. Many of those were independent non-Western countries, including all Latin American countries, Soviet bloc countries, India, which had become independent the year before, and China. The two blocks of, well, not even countries, but entities that were not involved were sub-Saharan African countries, practically all of whom were colonized at the time, and indigenous peoples, because it was a declaration by states, and indigenous peoples do not constitute formal states. Since then, however, there have been many, many more human rights treaties against torture, treaties against racial discrimination, women's rights, children's rights, rights of the disabled, and sub-Saharan African states and all other states have been involved in formulating those treaties.
These are 9 binding human rights treaties that kind of emerged from the Universal Declaration.
Yes, that's correct. So when they're treaties, that means that when governments sign on to them and ratify them, they are legally obliged to uphold those treaties. Mind you, all of this is, as one scholar called, organized hypocrisy. There's not much that the United Nations can do. These are United Nations treaties if a government decides not to uphold those treaties and not to adhere to their laws there. The other thing about the Declaration is that many people think it only covers what are considered to be Western human rights, civil and political rights, such as the right not to be tortured, the right to a fair trial, the right to vote. Well, first of all, those are not just Western human rights. If you talk to human rights activists from places like Iran or the Uyghurs in China, they want the right not to be tortured. They want the right not to be executed. They want the right to vote. Secondly, the Universal Declaration includes what's called economic, social, and cultural rights. And that includes things like the right to work, the right to health care, the right to education, the right to a decent standard of living. Article 25 even goes so far as to talk about an adequate standard of living, not even a minimal standard of living, an adequate standard of living for all human beings. The civil servant at the United Nations who did the first draft was John Humphreys, a law professor from McGill.
So this was John Peter Humphreys who he wrote the initial draft.
Yeah. John Humphrey, before he drafted the first draft of the Declaration, did a study of all the constitutions in the world, including the constitutions of Latin American countries and Soviet bloc countries. And these constitutions included economic rights, such as the right to health care and the right to education. So he put those in the first draft to reflect the views of those countries. He also included cultural rights, the right to enjoy your own culture. And one of the reasons for that was that he was married to a French Canadian. And he was aware of the discrimination against French Canadians in Quebec at that time in the 30s and 40s. So it is simply not true that this is only a Western document, nor is it true that it is only pertains to Western people. I once heard a scholar from India talking about how people in India didn't care about civil and political rights, and she cited some women activists who were environmentalists in India, saying that was much more important. So I said to her, you mean to tell me that it's okay in India for the police to torture, rape, and murder women activists? And she looked very startled. And I said, well, that's what you just told me. You just told me that civil and political rights didn't matter in India, that those are the rights that would protect in principle and perhaps even in fact your women activists from being raped, tortured, and murdered. So these are myths. It is a document that was drafted by people from practically every region of the world except sub-Saharan Africa and representatives of indigenous peoples. And in fact, people also sometimes say it's a colonial document. But in fact, the colonial powers didn't want this document to pertain to people in the colonies. Britain and France actively fought against making it pertain to people in the colonies.
Did they actually do that?
Yes, they did. But representatives from the colonies, nationalists from the colonies, attended the United Nations and said, we want this document to pertain to everyone, including us. It's simply not true that we're sort of lesser beings and we can't enjoy human rights yet. So they were the ones that pushed for it, and that's how it got in.
And it's interesting that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, when you read it, the language is very sparse, it's very simple, and it makes nowhere is there any reference to a particular culture or political system or religion. It's a very universalist document.
Yes. I mean, that's the product of months and months of debate and compromise among the representatives of various states. Also, I should mention, women's rights are in there. The right to non-discrimination as to sex, which was then meant biological sex, men and women. That's because of pressure from female activists and also from pressure from a separate committee on the status of women at the UN. So when it was drafted without language protecting women, the people who were in the committee of the status of women said, no, you've got to have equality for the sexes in that. Two of the other women involved in that, aside from Eleanor Roosevelt, were a representative from the Dominican Republic and a representative from India, I believe, women representatives. So they pushed for that to get in there. Also, the right to self-determination is something that the colonial representatives pushed for. There were African American representatives there trying to make sure that they were protected against discrimination on the basis of race, which is something the Americans didn't want to see in there because they were very busy discriminating on the basis of race.
I mean, which Americans opposed, can you name names? Which Americans back in 1948 were saying, no, 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 don't?
I think it was more the government as a whole. Eleanor Roosevelt was a very fine person, but she was still representing the government of the United States, as well as chairing that committee.
I'd like to go through the Universal Declaration kind of bit by bit, but paragraph 3 of the preamble, I always find kind of interesting because it's sort of implicit recognition of the rights to resist oppression and subjugation in any way that's available. And it says, whereas it is essential if man is not to be compelled to have recourse as a last resort to rebellion against tyranny and oppression, that human rights should be protected by the rule of law. So it's kind of like an implicit recognition of the right to resist.
I'm not an expert on what they call the preparatory documents, so I couldn't tell you what was actually discussed at the time about that. But you're right, it does say if you don't want people to rebel, then give them their rights. So you could imply, if they don't have their rights, it's your problem.
Let's talk about these various articles. Article 2 talks about no distinction shall be made on the basis of political, jurisdictional, or international status of the country or territory to which a person belongs.
That was because of people from the colonies pressuring to make sure that they were protected. But it does imply as well that if you are an individual in occupied territory, you have all these rights.
And then right to life, liberty, and security of person. No one shall be subjected to torture, to cruel or inhuman or degrading treatment, equality before the law, effective remedy by the competent national tribunals for acts that violate fundamental rights. It's Article 8. Article 9 talks about arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile.
These are all the so-called Western human rights. But I've never heard of somebody who is an activist in the so-called Global South saying, I don't want these rights because they're Western. Go ahead and torture me.
Who are these folks or these entities who say this is a Western document?
This is, I heard once on the Canadian CBC, a woman going on about how this is a colonial document. These are people who think everything the West does is colonial. Colonial is now a catch-all phrase for the evil West. It was a standard argument as early as the 1980s when I started working on international human rights. For example, I once met an African man who told me that African women didn't need human rights. So I came home and I asked one of my master's students from the Zambia, a woman, what she thought about that, the idea that African women didn't need human rights. And she said, well, my brother-in-law beat up my pregnant sister. He killed her, but the baby survived and he got custody of the baby. So that's my answer to whether African women needed human rights. Now, of course, there are many African female activists in Africa that weren't in 1980, and they assert that they need human rights.
And then Article 13, the rights to freedom of movement and residence. Article 14, the right to seek and to enjoy asylum in other countries. Right to a nationality. The right to a family, to marry. The right to own property.
On the right to a family, some LGBT activists have thought that that's discriminatory because it refers to men and women. And it's true that at the time, probably nobody was talking about the rights of gay people to marry each other or same-sex marriage. What they were interested in at the time was the right not to be arrested because of same-sex sexual activity. But you could argue now that the men and women is anachronistic, and the more important part is the right to marry and to found a family, regardless of whether you're same-sex or heterosexual activity. Then the right to own property. Now that was very controversial, and there was a lot of debate between, in this case, Western capitalist powers and the socialist bloc about that. And then the socialist bloc, or the Soviet Union, really eventually agreed to the phrase own property alone, as well as in association with others, claiming that Soviet policy, saying that all property was the property of the state, covered in association with others. Now, some people think that this is an unnecessary right. I have argued that it is necessary, at least for personal property. There are many countries of the world that deprive people of all their property, and they are very, very insecure. There are also countries that deprive peasants of their land. So one of the reasons for famine is that peasants are deprived of their land. The problem is, does this cover essentially capitalist property, the rights of corporations to own property? And there are countries especially where corporations are considered legally to be persons. Now, I disagree with that. I don't think corporations should have human rights. Corporations can have legal rights, but they should not be considered legal human beings. There's no international covenant subsequently on the right to property. So that's what's interesting. There is one on the rights of women, protection against racial discrimination, against torture, but there's no international covenant on the right to property. It sort of died. But when you think of this in part as a reaction against the Nazis in the 1940s, then you see why the right to property is there, because in Germany, between 33 and 39, Jews and other victims were deprived of their property, systematically deprived of their property.
And I mean, it's universalist. It makes no reference to any particular culture, religion, political system.
That's true. But some people, at least, had the Nazi period in the back of their mind and all the horrible things the Nazis did. Anyway, so to go ahead, if you'd like.
The right to take part in the government of the country, right to equal access to public service, universal and equal suffrage.
It says periodic and genuine elections, but not competitive elections. And again, that was a concession to the Soviet Union because they didn't want to have competitive elections. They were one-party states. So any elections that they had in the Soviet bloc were just pretty well a farce, as they are in many one-party states today. So that's, to my mind, a deficiency in this document.
Article 22, the right to social security, economic, social, and cultural rights. Article 23 talks about the right to work, the right to form and to join trade unions. Article 24 talks about the right to rest and leisure.
Now, again, that's been criticized, the right to rest and leisure, as being Western on the grounds that it, I don't know why, but it's also been criticized as frivolous, especially by a philosopher named Maurice Cranston back in the 80s. But if you think about it, how can somebody take a vacation if he's living paycheck to paycheck, or she's living paycheck to paycheck, and isn't paid to take that week's vacation or 2 weeks' vacation? Also, reasonable limits on working hours, that's not frivolous. We're talking about, in the West, societies that used to have people working 12-hour days until the 19th century, or the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And in the Global South, so-called, there are still people working 12-hour days, 14-hour days. So this is not frivolous. This is a reaction to the development of capitalist societies, societies in which practically everybody works for an employer, and that employer is going to exploit them unless they have protections.
But again, I think about people laboring away in fields and factories and across South Asia and up and down Latin America and in Africa, for whom rest and leisure, well, of course, it's a biological requirement that we all have to rest or else we die. But the reality tends to be different in much of the world, and much of the Global South.
Yeah, this is a principle. It's a universal principle, but it's something people can refer to. For example, when they organize labor or organize protest movements, can refer to this and say, we want a shorter working day. Now, if it's your own field you're laboring in, it's a different matter. But much agricultural is now capitalist agriculture. So if you're laboring away as an agricultural worker, you may need these protections just as much in the Global South, or even more in the Global South than in the Global North.
Let's talk about Article 25, which is, I think, close to your own heart and academic interests. Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, yeah. First of all, the word adequate, right, which is more than, as I said before, than minimal. It's adequate. It means, it should mean things like you're not living on inadequate social welfare payments where you have to choose between paying rent or buying food, essentially, which is the situation in Canada today. Secondly, some of this reflects the thinking of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He's famous for talking about the four freedoms in 1941, freedom from want, freedom from fear, freedom of speech, and freedom of religious belief, I think they were. But he actually made a speech in 1944 proposing all of these other things, proposing that every American should have all these kinds of protections, which of course Americans do not have even now. So I think it's important to notice that you saw himself and his family. That's just an artifact of the 1940s. It has no meaning now. I used to tell my students, I want you to read this document and I want you to critique it. But if one of your criticisms is that it says himself instead of herself, I'm not interested. It's obvious and it's boring. The second part of this is also important. Motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. And all children, whether born in and out of wedlock, shall enjoy the same social protection. Now, at that time, children whose parents weren't married didn't have the same protection as children whose parents were married. Also, motherhood and childhood implies, to my mind, things like universal paid maternity leave, which they don't have, for example, in the States. They still don't have it. They're way behind other Western countries. And I think universal paid maternity leave is extremely important so that mothers can be with their babies in the period of infancy and take care of them.
What's the situation vis-a-vis paid maternal leave in Canada?
If you are employed in Canada now, at least in Ontario, I don't know if it's universal offhand, you can take as many as 18 months off. You can get unemployment insurance, which would only be, depending on your income, a portion of your income, perhaps only a third, for 12 months. But if you want to, you can extend it for 18 months. So then you'd be getting a lesser period over 18 months. Your job has to be kept for you, and your seniority level has to be kept for you. So your employer cannot fire you for taking maternity leave. Contrast this with Sweden, which last I checked had 2 years of maternity leave, and with the United States, which has 6 weeks of unpaid leave for certain kinds of corporations, I think, depending on their size, only. So basically, in my view, as I've told many Americans who've interviewed me, the United States is an uncivilized country. Canada barely makes it as civilized, but the United States is definitely uncivilized.
Talk about the food part, the rights to food in Article 25.
Well, a lot of people think that that means the right for the government to provide you with food if you don't have it. And I think that's true. I mentioned the appallingly low welfare rates here in Canada at the moment. And you can go to newspapers now and every second day people will say, I'm living on welfare or I'm living on disability payments and I have to choose between rent and food. It's appalling. Canada has no national food policy. Millions of people are relying on food banks nowadays.
Article 26, everyone has the right to education. Article 27 talks about the right to freely participate in the cultural life of the community. Everyone has the right to the protection of the moral and material interests resulting from any scientific, literary, or artistic production. Article 28 is interesting. Everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration can be fully realized. This seems to get down to the nub of the problem, that we have this prevailing international order in the world today, which is really, one might argue, and I would argue, is kind of antithetical to achieving universal rights and freedoms.
Well, that's true. I just want to mention for Article 27, the protection of moral and material interests in scientific literature, literary and artistic production. I think that reflects the fact that a lot of the people who drafted this thing were academics. That's a legal right, to my mind. It shouldn't be a human right, and it shouldn't be in there. The social international order, you're quite right. That does say that there should be obligations not only by your own state, but by other states, to protect your human rights. And that is a reflection also somewhere, I think, in the later documents on right to foreign aid. And it's also something that people who are involved in writing, people who were drafted a right to development in 1986, that was a covenant, not a treaty, can refer to. And now there is activity at the UN led by my colleague, Dr. Bonnie Ibawo, a Nigerian Canadian, to try to draft a treaty on the right to development. But I'd also like to bring your attention to Article 29, which says everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full development of his personality is possible. Now, leaving aside the personality for a minute, a lot of people criticize the declaration claiming that there's too much attention to rights and not enough attention to duties, and that it's too individualistic and doesn't regard the community. And in fact, there was quite a big debate at the time about what community meant and so on. So this is the result, this short thing that says duties to the community. There have been attempts since then to draft international declarations on duties, but none of those attempts disregards rights. And I don't think it's true that these are individualistic. I think that if you enjoy your human rights, then you're in a better position to help the community. Now, sometimes you don't want to be in a community. If you're a woman living in a community where women are subject to the authority of men, you probably just think it'd be better if you could just get out of that community. And there are lots of communities like that. Or you can change the community and get equal rights for women. But if you have enough to eat, if you have enough education to think or to be able to put your thoughts into words, then you are more likely to participate in the community than if you don't have those rights. Somebody living on welfare in Canada is going to be hard put to contribute to the community if she doesn't even have enough money to get bus fare. She might want to volunteer. And a lot of people do, even if they're very poor living on welfare. I discovered this in a book I wrote on civic leaders in Hamilton, Ontario in 2003. A lot of poor people would like to volunteer, but they don't have the bus fare to do it. So who volunteers in Canada? Many middle-class people who enjoy their human rights, many middle-class women whose husbands make enough money for them not to have to have a paid job. They raise their kids and then they spend the rest of their lives volunteering for the community, opening women and women's shelters, advocating for the homeless, all that kind of thing. So I don't think that human rights are too individualistic, nor do I think they neglect the community or duties. But it's true, there's no international declaration on human duties.
But again, getting back to Article 28, everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in the declaration can be fully realized. It seems to me that the international order today is founded on the pursuit of power and money and the ability to project power. Think about the international arms industry and the oil and gas industry and the fact that something like 1,000 or 2,000 people control 99% of the wealth on the planet. This is not an international order here on Earth in which the rights and freedoms set forth in declaration can be realized.
Yeah, you're quite right. The world is run by guns and money, basically. And it's not run only by Western guns and money. It's run by guns and money everywhere, right? Right now, for example, China is very busy exploiting Africa and exploiting African workers. Non-Western governments are just as abusive as Western governments used to be before democracy or some attempt at democracy was introduced. You are quite right. So this is not only a statement about, say, the right to development, but it's also a statement about any exploitative business from any part of the world, and it's a statement about any abusive political group.
Can I ask you quickly, because we don't have too much time left, what does Article 30 mean, the last article? Nothing in this declaration may be interpreted as implying for any state, group, or person any right to engage in an activity or to perform an act aimed at the destruction of any of the rights and freedoms set forth herein.
Well, if that were actually implemented, it would mean that anyone in any government anywhere in the world who limited anyone's right to vote, to eat, to have an education, would be doing something not illegal, but wrong. This is not a treaty, so you can't arrest them for that, but that's what it would mean.
But it sounds like it's saying that nothing in this declaration declaring all these various human rights gives anyone the right to deny the rights.
That's exactly what it says. That's exactly what it says. And if it were a law, we could go around arresting practically everybody in government in every part of the world. But it's not a law.
So it's a self-protective. Is it an escape clause?
No, it's not self-protective. My guess is, I don't know about this, that there was a big debate even about putting this in here, because you could extrapolate the way I've just extrapolated. Don't forget, this is a normative statement. At the time when the Nazis persecuted Jews in Germany, that was not illegal. You could do whatever you wanted to citizens of your own state. It was illegal for the Nazis to then go around occupying the rest of Europe. But this is a big step forward at the time. But you're right to draw attention to it, because if it ever were international, actual hard international law, then everybody could be arrested. Right now, political and military leaders, including sitting heads of state, can be arrested under universal jurisdiction for crimes against humanity and genocide. But they can't be arrested simply for denying people in their country their human rights. So you can't arrest the leaders of Iran for denying rights to women, or the leaders of Saudi Arabia, which is actually worse, for denying rights to women. You can't arrest heads of state for depriving indigenous people of their land. None of that is international law at the moment. If this ever were law, it would be wonderful. But it isn't right now. It's just an aspirational statement.
And so the Canadian government has acknowledged the fact that Canada committed genocide against First Nations people, but nobody can be tried for it.
Well, yeah, you can't. I mean, first of all, you can't try people who are dead. I'm not sure if the Canadian government has actually acknowledged genocide. Yeah, but you can't. You can't do it. You cannot arrest the Canadian government now for continued massive incarceration of Indigenous people, for underfunding their educational programs, for underfunding their child welfare programs. All those things that are now currently going through the courts or are part of a lot of national discussion. You can't arrest Justin Trudeau for doing that, for being the head of state, for those kinds of things. No.
Rhoda Hassman, last question. What's the relevance of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights today on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of its passage, the 75th anniversary of its passage?
It's an aspirational document to which many activists for their human rights pay attention. They can use it. They can say to their governments, you signed on to this document, so we want our rights. It's also the basis for a lot of international law. As we've already discussed, laws against torture, laws against racial discrimination. So it has real relevance there as well. And sometimes it's used as basis for human rights in foreign policy. And sometimes it's used as a basis for states to criticize other states at the UN, perhaps utterly hypocritically. But occasionally, researchers have shown that some states, especially those that want more legitimacy in the international arena, will change their policies. So, and it's also used, for example, by the European Court of Human Rights, by the American Court of Human Rights Latin American document, and even by the African Union, which has an African document on human rights. So it's a very long, slow process. You have to compare the world now to the world 75 years ago and see that a lot of changes have occurred, even though especially if you're a younger person, you may be extremely impatient about that. I, as an older person, am also impatient. I would like everyone in the world to enjoy all their human rights right now, but sadly they don't.
Rhoda Hassman, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Rhoda Howard Hassman is a Canadian social scientist specializing in international human rights From 2003 to 2016, she held the Canada Research Chair in International Human Rights at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario. In June 2023, Hassman was appointed to the Order of Canada. Listen to my complete conversation with Rhoda Hassman, including her thoughts on the denial of food rights in North Korea, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, and the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. According to the Universal Declaration, everyone has the right to life, liberty, and personal security. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest or detention, it says, or to degrading treatment, punishment, or torture. All human beings are equal before the law, presumed innocent until proven guilty, well defended in a public trial. In the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories, these rights are routinely and systematically denied. Since the start of Israel's belligerent occupation 55 years ago, the Israeli military has jailed an estimated million Palestinians, typically inside Israel proper, in flagrant violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, often without charge. Palestinian prisoners are routinely abused, denied food and medical treatment, and tortured. Hundreds of youths and children are detained each year. I spoke about Israel's carceral system with Milena Ansari. Ansari is international advocacy officer with the Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, a Palestinian NGO based in Ramallah, occupied Palestine. Tell me about Adamir. What does Adamir do?
So we're a civil society, a human rights organization. As I mentioned, we focus on Palestinian political prisoners, but it's important to note that we focus on Palestinian political prisoners held both in Israeli occupation prisons and the Palestinian Authority as well. So we provide free legal aid to the detainees and their families. We also advocate on their behalf on an international level. So doing reporting to the United Nations, to the ICC as well, the International Criminal Court, and briefings with representatives to highlight issues of concerns regarding prisoners or certain cases of Palestinian prisoners. We also have a legal a research and documentation unit that they do regular prison visits and interviews with prisoners and former prisoners and their families to document the systematic violations of Palestinian prisoners' rights. So this includes solitary confinement, torture and ill-treatment, medical neglect inside Israeli prisons, harsh detention conditions, because Israeli prisons are characterized that they are inadequate for human living. They lack the adequate living standards for any human being. So there's harsh detention conditions. And of course, for legal services, we really focus on administrative detention, which is a procedure that the Israeli occupation uses to detain Palestinians without charges, without trial, based on secret information and for an indefinite time. So the Israeli military commander issues an order that's called an administrative detention order that says this person may impose a future risk to the security of Israel, so we should detain them inside prison to avoid any security threats. But of course, there is absolutely no security threat. It is mainly to maintain control over the Palestinians. And I say this because for 30 years, we've seen administrative detention being used against children, against women, civil society actors, where the Israeli occupation fails to provide a list of charges, so they go to administrative detention where they just say secret information and the military judge confirms the order and the person is in detention for an indefinite time.
How many Palestinian prisoners is Israel now holding in jail?
So there are around 4,600 Palestinian political prisoners in general. 600 of them are administrative detainees, so held without charge, without trial, for an indefinite time.
And many of these are held inside prisons within the Green Line.
Exactly. So there are 18 Israeli occupation prisons where Palestinians are held, and only one is located inside the West Bank. Ofar prison. The rest are all located inside Israel, which is in violation of international humanitarian law, because this is considered the crime of forcibly transferring prisoners of the occupied territory outside of their territory.
Prisoners detained by the occupying power
inside
must be detained within the borders of the occupied territory.
Yeah, and this is not the only violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, because Israeli military courts are also implementing Israeli laws and legislation and procedures against Palestinians. And of course, you cannot enforce the occupied powers' legislation on the occupied people. And I say this because Israeli military orders that are the basis, that act as the law, the legislation in the occupied territory, criminalize almost every aspect of a Palestinian life. So when Israeli military orders are used in military courts, there's always no chance for true justice or accountability in these military courts, because the judge is an Israeli military officer, the prosecutor is an Israeli military officer, the language spoken is Hebrew, a language Palestinians don't know, and the law that's used against them is Israeli military law. So the whole system is built so no true justice is given to Palestinians. Just one information, B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization, this is a statistic from them that says the conviction rate in Israeli military courts for Palestinians is 99.7%. So you can understand that there's no actual rule of law being implemented. It's just a system that plays an integral role in delegitimizing the Palestinian people and the right to self-determination in general.
And what are the conditions of those prisoners inside of Israeli jails?
So Israeli prisons where Palestinians are held there arbitrarily, mainly they are described as overcrowded, lack of sufficient ventilation and natural lighting. So when I say overcrowding, we mean more than 8 prisoners in a cell that doesn't fit more than 4 or more than 6. Inside prisons, there's absolutely no proper food. The prisoners are left to cook their own food, and they are given certain amount each day or each week, and they cook their own. But that being said, there's complete medical neglect in Israeli prison services, where Palestinian prisoners, if they have sustained injuries prior to their arrest, or they have chronic illnesses, they are not given the proper treatment as the Geneva Conventions clearly state. Inside Israeli prisons, there's definitely this policy of deliberate medical neglect, where the Israeli prison services doesn't provide the Palestinians with the proper treatment. An example of this is the case of Jamal Zaid. Jamal Zaid is an elderly Palestinian who's under administrative detention. So he's detained without charge, without trial, based on secret information. And he was arrested from September 2021. And he is undergoing dialysis because he has kidney failure and other health conditions like high blood pressure. And now I can't think of them, but I think he has diabetes as well. So even a person who's suffering from medical conditions can be detained in Israeli prisons without a list of charges, without trial. So the Israeli prison services were aware of Jamal's condition and that he has to undergo dialysis 3 times a week. So he's held in a Ramle prison clinic. So Ramle Prison Clinic is reported by the prisoners as the slaughterhouse. It is far from any clinic or medical facility that anyone can imagine.
And it's inside of Israel.
It's in Ramle, yes. It's like in the occupied 1948 territories, if we want to be accurate with the definitions. So even when he's undergoing dialysis, inside the prison clinic, they don't have a proper medical staff. There's no full medical staff on board all the time. What the Israeli prison services do as well is they keep at least three Palestinian prisoners who are healthy and well to take care of the other sick and wounded or ill prisoners. So in Jamal's case, the dialysis session takes around 4 hours. And this is completely medical neglect because it shouldn't be taking that long. And the transport from the dialysis room to back to his room in the Ramle prison clinic entails a lot of harshness because they are still shackled by their hands and feet at the whole time. And even if they want to be transferred to an Israeli hospital for better treatment in a way, and I'm using quotes because it's still arbitrary treatment, the transportation, the trip to the prison clinic, to the hospital, takes long hours, and they are transferred by something that's called Bosta. Many Palestinian prisoners like always report on their experiences and hardship in El Bosta, which is basically a metal vehicle that transports the prisoners from the prison to clinic or the court. So it's a really degrading and harsh trip. So Jamal Zaid decided to boycott the dialysis sessions because he said the treatment in these clinics is arbitrary and I'm detained with no reasons and no charges. So now Jamal is not boycotting the dialysis sessions anymore because he missed three sessions and that really affected and deteriorated his health conditions. So I mean, it was either he will completely, I don't want to say it, or he continues with the dialysis session. But even when prisoners use hunger strikes to put pressure on the Israeli occupation doesn't care. It doesn't understand the gravity of the situation or arbitrariness. We have hunger striking detainees who reached 100 days without food. And this only shows that the IPS don't really care what happens to a prisoner's life.
How many children, how many minors are being held in Israeli prisons?
170.
At this moment?
Yes. And one, the case of Ahmed Manasra was one of these numbers. And I would like to highlight the case of Ahmed Manasra, who was arrested when he was 13 years old. Until now, he's in Israeli prisons. I think he served 7 years now. Ahmed's case.
So he's 20 years old now, and he was 13 when he was first arrested.
Yes, he became a teenager. He became a man inside Israeli prisons. But his case is brutal, because, and I'll be honest, and I'll tell you the case from the beginning. He was arrested while in Jerusalem for allegedly planning to stab, an incident of stabbing. And we're talking about a 13-year-old boy here. That's really important to always bear in mind. He was with his cousin, who during the incident or the attack, because it's all allegations, there hasn't been any concrete evidence that show. But regardless of that, his cousin, who was a child as well with him, was killed. So he died during the attack itself. And Ahmed was subjected, so he saw his cousin being killed and died at that time.
And when was this? When did this happen?
I'm not sure exactly of the date, but if we say 7 years from now, so yeah. But his case is also online. There's an ongoing campaign for the case of Ahmed Manasra, because during interrogation, there is a video clip of his interrogation. The Israeli interrogator was psychologically abusing Ahmed Manasra as a child during interrogation. There were no lawyers present. There was constant screaming and yelling and cursing at Ahmed, cursing his family, cursing himself directly. And Ahmed kept saying, I don't remember. I don't know what happened. I can't remember. My head hurts. Because during the incident as well, he sustained a head injury in his skull. So he had a few injuries in his head as well. And he kept saying, I can't. I don't remember. It hurts. My head hurts. And the interrogator kept yelling and screaming on and on. But the case becomes more arbitrary when the Israeli prison services put Ahmed in solitary confinement for more than 5 years because he was facing psychological conditions inside prison. Because if you can imagine a 13-year-old being subjected to ill treatment in interrogation and seeing his cousin passing away exactly during his arrest, and also being sentenced to 9 years inside Israeli prison without the proper treatment for children, because children have a vulnerability. For the Convention for the Rights of Children says that the deprivation of liberty for children should come as a last resort, and it should be for a small duration of time. Children should not be in solitary confinement. But Ahmed Wanasra was subjected to so many ill treatment and torture that he had psychological health conditions. His health condition is seriously bad, that he's not aware of his surroundings. And the Israeli prison services are putting him in solitary confinement because they say he might be a threat or a threat to the prisoners inside prison. So instead of properly treating Ahmed and providing him with the treatment that he needs, the Israeli prison services' solution is to put him in solitary confinement, isolated from everyone and from support and from human interaction.
Am I correct that something approaching 40% of the male Palestinian population have spent time in Israeli jails?
In every family in Palestine, for sure you will have one family member that was either arrested, detained, or imprisoned. So yes, there is a high number of Palestinian male prisoners.
I mean, there's hardly a family in Palestine.
Exactly,
there's hardly a Palestinian family who hasn't had at least one member of their family jailed for extensive periods of time.
Definitely.
And there are many, many Palestinians, particularly Palestinian males, who've been in and out of prisons on and off since they were children and have had experiences, have been detained on multiple occasions over the course of their life. So the burden of imprisonment in Israeli jails, the population kind of burden, is huge, isn't it?
Yes, so I will talk about the male prisoners and their conditions of detention, but it's really important to bear in mind that although there are only 32 female prisoners, but Palestinian women prisoners are subjected to more gender-based violences than male prisoners, which mainly during interrogation, during the strip searches, inside the prison themselves, because most of the Palestinian women prisoners, or there is a good number of women prisoners who wear the headscarf inside prison, and the prison guards are mainly male prison guards. So inside prison, Palestinians are women are not afforded the privacy or the respect of their life in general. But again, it's more about the gender-based violences during interrogation, the psychological torture, threats of rape, the invasive body searches, and all that. But that being said, the majority of prisoners are male prisoners, because the Israeli occupation understands the important role of males in an Arab society. They are the support for the families. They are the fathers, the brothers. I'm not in any way undermining the role of women, because they are the mothers and the root of resistance and solidarity in Palestine. They target males because they want them to understand that Israel is in control. To keep in mind that regardless of what happens, if you try to resist through throwing stones, or if you try to resist through being in an organization like Al-Damir that does civil society work, you will be targeted because you are criminalized as a person. You're delegitimized. You don't have any rights or any protection in this area where you are living, and this is your homeland. So torture, extreme torture, is used against Palestinian male prisoners, where there are many stress positions that they are subjected to, sleep deprivation, also threats of arresting family members. The charges or the sentences against them are extremely exaggerated and high sentences, because it also affects the social dynamics inside Palestine and between the Palestinians. It becomes like most of our youth and most of our influential activists are inside prison. So there's no also leadership for Palestine to move towards the liberation of Palestine. There's always harsh detention conditions are all the same for all prisoners. But yes, the imprisonment of the majority of male Palestinians is to really cut down any hope of a liberated Palestine, because there's a majority of the Palestinian population inside prison. There's no hope of continuing this resistance against the occupation.
Milena Ansari is the international advocacy officer with the Al-Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, a Palestinian NGO based in Ramallah, occupied Palestine. For more information about the institutionalized incarceration of Palestinians under Israeli occupation and Al-Damir's advocacy on their behalf, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.